At Highland, we're all about celebrating little wins and little ways to innovate digital processes. There's no customer pain point too small for us to help with. Maybe that's why more than half of the Fortune 100 looks to Highland to connect their content and data, improve processes, and turn little efficiencies into big wins for their customers and clients. Highland, intelligent content solutions for innovators everywhere at highland.com.
The Future Proof Podcast from Newstalk.
Proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland. Hashtag believe in science.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof, the podcast. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. My name is Jonathan McRae. Thanks as always for subscribing, downloading and rating and letting people know about the show generally. We really do appreciate it. If you'd like to contact us here on the show, you can email us, science@newstalk.com. You can find us on Twitter. We're @NewstalkScience. Now, Tuesday was the 52nd anniversary of the moon landing. So we thought we'd take this opportunity to replay our moon landing anniversary special from a couple of years back. We'll be hearing the voices of some well-known people who remember the day itself. We'll hear about Ireland's very own piece of the moon. And also we'll find out how studying the rocks that Apollo astronauts brought back has helped us come up with a new understanding of how the moon got there in the first place. First, though, we all know about Neil Armstrong, one giant leap and all that. But did you know that 20th of July 1969 wasn't actually our first successful moon landing? So when did we first get there and when are we going back? Oliver Morton is senior editor at The Economist and author of The Moon, A History for the Future. He joins me now. Welcome back to the programme, Oliver. There's a really early film called Le Voyage dans la Lune, and it depicted this sort of fantastic journey to the moon in which a rocket sort of plonks right in the middle of it. And it sort of illustrated at the time how little we knew about the rock that goes around our Earth. But when did the ideas of going to the moon start to get a bit more realistic? Before we became, I suppose, technologically capable of going?
Well, the big date in understanding the moon is 1610, because that's when Galileo publishes his book about what he's seen through his telescope. And that book very quickly establishes in people's minds that whatever they used to think about the moon, whether it was a perfect crystal or whatever, now they can see that it's a pockmarked face with dents in it and flat dark bits which might be seas. And it's a world with features in the same way that the Earth is. And this is an very important and somewhat scandalous idea at the time, because the idea that the moon is a world is linked to the idea that the Earth, the world, is a planet like the moon and is not the center of the universe, as Aristotle and the church have taught, but is instead wandering through space like all the other planets. And so to think the moon is Earth-like is to think that the Earth is moon-like. And this is a big step in people's conception of the cosmos. As time, and so that leads to people thinking that, you know, if the moon is Earth-like, then there must be moon people like there are Earth people. And that's a staple of what people speculate about in writing about the moon from that time onwards. You know, what sort of people live on a world where the days are 14 days long and the nights are 14 days long, but in Earth terms, and where the sun, where the sun shines down so brightly. And these are questions that people ask themselves, although they decide that people on the moon are probably bigger, though it's not entirely clear why. Then later on, as it becomes clear that the moon has no atmosphere, has no real seas, just these dark patches we call seas, as that becomes clear, people start thinking, well, maybe the moon people live inside the moon. And then they start thinking, well, maybe the moon people are all dead. And by the 19th century, that's how people see the moon. They see it as a dead and a desolate place. And so it becomes sort of like an emptiness onto which to project ideas about the human future. And the obvious idea to project is that humans might go there. And so you go from, in the 17th century, speculation about how you might go to the moon pulled by a flight of geese. That's in one of the earliest moon fictions in the English language.
That would be awesome.
Yeah, that would be great. They are actually special geese.
Oh, of course.
But yeah, and you have to take off from Tenerife in the Canary Islands, and it takes a long time, but the geese will do it. And then by the 19th century, you have the much more technological idea. I mean, in some ways, almost as far-fetched, of shooting a bullet to the moon with people inside it, which is vaguely plausible, except the fact that the people would be crushed into sort of like raspberry jam by the acceleration. And then around the same time, not long after Jules Verne has written From the Earth to the Moon with his giant gun, people start realizing, Konstantin Tsiolkovsky in Imperial Russia is the first to really see this, that there is a technology which could take humans to the moon, and that's rockets fueled by liquid fuels. And once that is understood, you are effectively on the path that leads to Apollo.
There were moon people in the end, and they didn't live on the moon for very long. They touched very briefly and then headed off back again. But before Apollo 11 ever touched down, there were lots of missions to the moon, not just near it, but around it and onto it. Before then, what do we know about the surface and its makeup?
Well, there are good telescopes that can give you nice, decent pictures of the moon from the early 19th century onwards. And it becomes very clear that the most noticeable thing about the moon is that its features are fundamentally changeless. There are a few little events that people think they see, and that's something that goes on in lunar astronomy to this day. But basically, everything always stays the same. And that implies quite strongly to people that this is basically solid rock. And the big question in moon science at that point is the craters in the moon, are they where something went in, where something hit the moon from outside, or are they where something came out? Are they sort of like volcanic structures? And opinion tends towards the volcanic for quite a long time. But by the middle of the 20th century, and this is partly because by the middle of the 20th century, people have seen big craters made by bombs and have a sense of what it is to blow a crater in a landscape. Mm. It becomes increasingly understood that the craters are made by things hitting the moon from the outside. And so this idea of solid rock hit by things from the outside that have created these craters, sometimes filled in by lava flows later. That's the basic idea of the moon before people get started on Apollo. And that's basically still the idea now. The moon is a big solid rock that gets hit by stuff.
But wasn't there worries that the Apollo landings would sort of sink into the surface at some stage?
There was an idea championed by a very feisty British physicist called Tommy Gold, who delighted in telling geologists that physicists were clever than geologists, that the moon's surface had been so thoroughly hit by other rocks that it had been turned into something almost like talcum powder, and that when people landed on it, anything on it would just sink into this talcum powder as though it was a sort of like viscous liquid, as though it was a quicksand. And one of the reasons that people weren't too worried about that by the time we got to Apollo was that during the 1960s, various probes without any people on, both Russian and American, had hit the surface of the moon first and then had landed on the surface of the moon and had stayed there without sinking. So Tommy Gold was right that the top layers of the moon have been hit by an awful lot of stuff and ground up pretty fine into moon dust, but that doesn't mean that you'll sink into them.
Then the missions that reached the moon without people on them, what were the early ones and what did they find out before Apollo landed?
Well, the first great moon mission is a Soviet mission called Luna 3, and it's great because it's the first mission to pass by the far side of the moon and to send back pictures of the side of the moon that humans have never seen, which is interestingly, and I think quite surprisingly in some ways, still in some ways quite surprisingly, looks very different from the near side of the moon. If humans had seen the far side of the moon all through their history, we wouldn't have had any of this malarkey about a man in the moon, because there are very few features on the far side. Those big grey features that make up the surface, that make up our picture of the moon, those only happen on the Earth side. So that was an interesting thing. Then the Americans and later the Russians pioneered what are politely or euphemistically called hard landings or impactors, where you just send a spacecraft straight at the moon and it goes straight into the moon and you get better and better close-ups as it goes in, and then you get nothing after it's hit. And so that was the next phase. And then you get the phase where they start doing these soft landers. So the American ones were called Surveyor, where you settle down on the moon and look around you and work out whether this is a good way to land people. Because by the time we've got to the Surveyor program and its counterpart, which is the Lunar Orbiter program, which puts probes into orbit around the moon that can take pictures and send them back to the Earth. Once you've got to that stage, you're well on the way to Apollo. I mean, those missions are taking place while people are developing the Apollo spacecraft and the vast Saturn V rockets that will send them to the moon.
People are very familiar with Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin getting this step down onto the moon and poor Michael Collins in the command module orbiting but never actually getting to step on the moon. But there were missions after that that people know a little bit less.
There were five subsequent successful moon landings, 12, 14, 15, 16 and 17. But Apollo 13 is the one that most people know of because it had its almost fatal accident. Apollo 12 was remarkable because it landed a few hundred meters from one of the Surveyor landers. And so they landed and they could see another human spacecraft out of their window, which was quite remarkable. Unfortunately, one of the astronauts turned the television camera straight into the sun very soon after landing. And so there were no TV images from the surface of the moon on Apollo 12, and that didn't go very well.
Yeah.
Then people got excited again with the first lunar rover, which was Apollo 15, and you could actually have people moving quite a long way away from the lander and really explore the landscape. And then you started seeing some rather more dramatic landscapes than you'd seen earlier on. And by the last landing, the Apollo 17 landing, they're actually at the foothills of some really quite impressive mountains. And so things did get more spectacular and also much more scientifically productive as the later missions came along and people stayed on the surface a bit longer and they did longer traverses across the surface using the rovers. But it's true that for most people and, you know, for the history books, the most important thing was when the first people landed, looked around and came back safely.
Yeah. So now we're talking about returning to the moon in the footsteps of those Apollo missions. China is aggressively pursuing that space mission, and the US have now sort of made this a mission that they want to get back to the moon. Why? What can we learn from new missions there, do you think? And what is the motivation? Is this Space Race 2?
It's a bit space racy, but you've got to remember Space Race 1 wasn't entirely space racy because the Russians weren't running anything like as hard as the Americans were. The difference now is that it's considerably easier to go into space. The rockets that people have now are not sort of like more impressive than the Saturn V's, which were still most extraordinary rockets. But because, for instance, people have learned how to assemble things in space. So we have a pretty large space station in orbit that was assembled out of dozens of flights from lots of different components. You no longer need a huge, big rocket to go to the moon, though it's quite handy. You could imagine putting together moon missions in orbit. And it's just easier to build spacecraft. I mean, don't forget, they had barely any computer-aided design. They had a much more skimpy set of aerospace materials to work from.
And everything burnt or blew up or had the potential to break down.
Yeah,
the computers
absolutely.
Were...
Absolutely. Yeah. But absolutely. So it's not that going to the moon is easy now. It's still a horrendously difficult thing. But it's a lot easier. So if you're a country as powerful and capable as China, you're not putting that much on the line to say you want to go to the moon because no one will be that upset if you're a bit late going to the moon. And it's pretty likely that if you put enough effort into it, you'll be able to do it.
But I think, as you reference in the book, General Homer A. Bushi said, "He who controls the moon controls the Earth." Is that still, you know, we keep being assured that we're not creating a military zone in space, but I think it's naive to think that that is not an aim for at least China, Russia, and America.
It's plausibly strategic, but there's really not. I mean, military people tend to try and occupy places where there's something useful, and there's really not much that's useful on the moon. And since people, I mean, it's true, people talk about armed, nuclear-armed moon bases in the 1940s and 1950s, even into the 1960s. But it's much easier, if you want to drop a nuclear bomb from space, it's much easier to shoot it up from space immediately prior to that dropping on a missile than it is to lift it up into a long way into space, leave it there for years, and then have it work in a way that it takes days to get back to the Earth. So the way that people think about fighting nuclear wars really doesn't require the moon.
So why are they going back? Why is it all of a sudden become really important?
If you look up at the sky and ask, where do I want to go? There are no obvious other answers, right? It's far and away the easiest other planetary surface to go to. So once you've got beyond going into near-Earth orbit and making a space station, it is so much easier to go to the moon that if you think going into space at all makes sense, and countries seem to have decided that it does for people, then the moon is the obvious first step after low Earth orbit. And that was true in the 60s, and that's true now. And so if you want to show off, going to the moon is the way to do it. And it's much, much less expensive than it used to be. So that's a lot of the story. There are other stories. Some people claim that there might be valuable resources on the moon, though I tend to think that they have sort of like decided they want to go to the moon first and make up their stories about resources later.
So to update JFK's iconic 1962 speech, "We choose to go to the moon not because it is easy, but because it is relatively hard." Because it's sort of hard.
Because it's not as hard as all that, but it's still pretty flash. I mean, come on, if you could go to the moon, why wouldn't you?
Well, the book is called The Moon. It is quite a comprehensive book that talks about anything really you need to know about the history of the moon, the culture of the moon, the future of the moon, the surface of the moon. And it's quite a lovely book. Do check it out. The Moon by Oliver Morton. Oliver, thank you very much.
You're very welcome. Nice to be on the show.
And it is quite a beautiful book, actually. Aidan McKelvey, our producer, sort of pilfered it after I had a flick through it. So do look out for it. Now, on the way, we used to own a piece of the moon itself. Where did it go? I'll see you on the dark side.
I was a young 8-year-old living in Kilkenny, and my mother woke myself and my sister up to come down and look at a black and white telly, a small black and white telly. And I remember being actually quite scared as an 8-year-old, thinking that, you know, there was something more outside the earth. But it was a fascinating time to think in those days, in 1969, that this could actually be achieved. And even as an 8-year-old, as I say, I was intrigued, I was terrified, and I was fascinated.
Did you know we once got a gift of a piece of the moon from America? Here's the story. On the 12th of September 1962 at Rice University in Houston, Texas, President John F. Kennedy, with the unsettling background of growing Soviet power, announced a bold mission: to put man on the moon.
But why, some say, the moon? Why choose this as our goal? And they may well ask, why climb the highest mountain? Why, 35 years ago, fly the Atlantic? We choose to go to the moon. We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other things, not because they are easy, but because they are hard. Because that challenge is one that we're willing to accept, one we are unwilling to postpone, and one we intend to win, and the others too.
It took $25 billion
2,721 tons of fuel and the efforts of 400,000 people to get there. But the two men who walked on the moon's surface were to return empty-handed. Well, almost empty-handed.
Apollo 11, man's first landing on the moon. There was no objective more important to science than the collection and return of samples from the lunar surface. For never before had we the opportunity to examine extraterrestrial material from a positively known location and context.
They picked up kilograms of material from the moon, but I think they had so much that they could afford to break up this particular rock into small pieces.
That's Ian Elliott, a retired astrophysicist. We'll explain where he fits in a little bit later. But anyway, back to this rock, the rock stolen from the moon. There was almost 400 kilograms taken during the Apollo missions from 1969 to 1972.
They were delivered to the Lunar Receiving Laboratory at the Manned Spacecraft Center, Houston, Texas. The importance of the event was underscored by the presence of top NASA officials.
My name is Randy Korotev. I'm a research professor at Washington University in St. Louis in the Department of Earth and Planetary Sciences.
Okay, and have you ever seen these moon rocks that were taken back from Apollo 11?
Oh, yes. I got to study the first ones back in 1969. I was working in a laboratory at the University of Wisconsin in Madison when the leader of the laboratory said, well, we're going to get some of the samples back when they come back this summer. That would have been July of 1969. And sometime around October, I think they showed up at our lab.
They were then prepared for preliminary physical and chemical analysis.
A lot of these samples had been what was called the preliminary examination that was done at the Johnson Space Center in Houston. So we kind of knew, this is a basalt and this is a breccia. You know, it's a different kind of rock. But most of the ones we got had not been studied at all before.
Did you find anything particularly exciting when you looked at this moon rock? Or was it sort of a little upsetting to realize that something that had been taken from so far away was actually so familiar?
At the time, I was so young and inexperienced that anything was exciting to me. In retrospect, I can say that the Apollo 11 moon rocks were basalts, which is a kind of rock we have, a volcanic rock that we have on Earth. They're made of the same minerals that occur here on Earth. In fact, there's probably only four minerals that make up 99% of all moon rock. I like to say that there are four minerals that make up 99% of the moon, and then there's another 50 minerals that make up the last 1%. They're minerals that any geology student would know: olivine, pyroxene, plagioclase, and ilmenite. Benels, deleite, and zirconolite, and apatite, and merylite, a lot of minerals with funny names.
When people like Randy had finished testing, the rock was distributed across the world by President Nixon. Each piece was encased in acrylic with a flag for the country it was destined to, the flag that had travelled on the space mission of Apollo 17. So back to Ian Elliott. He's a solar astrophysicist who was working at the Dunsink Observatory back in the 60s. And he was one of the recipients of this rock. A tiny piece of moon rock with an Irish flag on it.
One for Ireland was presented to President Hillary. And then when he went out of office, they had to decide what would happen, all the gifts that he'd been given. So it was decided to send the piece of moon rock to the observatory.
Oh, so the observatory didn't... originally, they weren't the recipient of the moon rock.
No, it was President Hillary on behalf of the Irish nation.
The current street value for a rock that size, if you can buy it, 5 million euro. Do you remember the day you received it? I mean, it must have been quite exciting.
Oh, I don't remember that at all.
Oh, really?
No. I'm not impressed too much by bits of the moon.
Well, that's kind of sad. Because this was a piece of history. A piece of the moon.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
The pale disc in the sky that's launched a thousand love songs.
You saw the whole of the moon.
and sci-fi movies.
That's no moon. It's a space station.
To muster up courage to challenge the black, airless void of terror-stricken space.
Come back to me, Jobs. Please, come back.
It's the moon. So what happened next?
The 3rd of October, 1977. Director was out of the country. He was actually in Scotland. And there was just a son and a daughter living in the domestic part of the observatory, which is on the south side of the main building. And the son was going to bed at about 20 past one, and he noticed flames coming from part of the meridian room. So he raised the alarm. The fire started in the basement and spread quite quickly. In 20 minutes, the fire brigade from Finglas arrived and they did their best to put out the fire. But it engulfed the whole of the meridian room, and the heavy bookshelves with all the books just collapsed into the basement, and all the books and all that went on fire.
So where is it now?
Well, you can just imagine the mess there was after a fire involving books. And unfortunately, the moon rock just disappeared into the basement along with all the other rubbish. And so all the rubbish was dumped in the municipal dump, which was just opposite the observatory on the Dunsink Lane. So it was very convenient, but that's where the moon rock ended up.
So it just got thrown out with the rubbish to the dump in Dunsink. Somewhere deep below decades of nappies, crisp packets and banana skins from that magical time in history lies a piece of the moon.
What is it you want, Barry? What do you want? You want the moon? Just say the word and I'll throw a lasso around it and pull it down. Hey, that's a pretty good idea. I'll give you the moon, Barry.
I'll take it.
Love to get your thoughts on that story. You can email us, science@newstalk.com, or you can find us on Twitter. We're at Newstalk Science. On the way, how did the moon get there in the first place?
I was still 9 years of age, and I do have a memory of this, of staring at a black and white television, because we didn't have colour in those days. And there was a couple of aspects. First of all, oh my God, this is a moment, a bit like the John F. Kennedy assassination. You remember where you were at the time. And a sense that it was something quite different.
I was 19, and I think I may have belonged in the only family in Ireland that was neither interested nor impressed by the moon landing.
The images were ghost-like. They weren't solid human beings. They floated almost like spectral images, and that again increased the fascination.
But I remember, in general, the excitement in Ireland at it. They kept on playing President Kennedy's words. I was married and I had young children. They were very young, you know, so they were put to bed. I remember End and I going out the back into the garden, but I don't think we saw anything startling or anything that would resemble a man in the moon, but we had our imaginations anyway.
I can remember just being gobsmacked, and I think my dad and my mother in particular were absolutely gobsmacked. And it just seemed like science fiction. But I think I was at an age where it kind of tied in all of the other science fiction that I was watching, which was Star Trek. It was an incredible achievement. And I feel as engaged by it, or if not more so now, one of mankind's finest moments.
Now, it's fair to say the Apollo program was probably at least as much a political venture as it was a scientific one. And this is reflected in the fact that only one scientist, Harrison Schmitt, ever stepped foot on the moon. Nonetheless, some scientific questions were asked and answered, and perhaps the biggest of these was in relation to the origin of our only natural satellite. So where did the moon come from, and how did Apollo help us figure that out? Well, Sarah T. Stewart is a professor in the Department of Earth and Planetary Sciences at UC Davis. She joins me now. Hi, Sarah.
Hi.
I thought I'd, you know, put this to bed, and I understood where the moon came from. And every time I, you know, every couple of years I revisit this subject, and it turns out that I've gotten it wrong, or that scientists have changed their mind and we don't know where the moon came from again. So maybe you might take us back to the sort of general understanding of where the moon came from and then why that's problematic.
Well, the Apollo mission was key in overturning all of the previously held ideas for forming the moon. And so when scientists looked at the data from the Apollo mission, they determined that they had to come up with a completely new idea. And it was in the aftermath of the mission that the giant impact theory was developed. And in this model, a Mars-sized object struck the growing Earth and created a debris disk around the Earth, and the moon grew from that debris disk.
Yeah, so just to stop you there, did we not know that before Apollo, or did we not think that before Apollo, or what was the prevailing theory?
There were three prevailing theories. One was called fission, where the moon spun off from the growing Earth. One was capture, and one was co-accretion, where the moon just grew along with the Earth the whole time. And none of those theories panned out with the Apollo data. The giant impact idea was not even mentioned early on in studies of planet formation. The idea of giant impacts really only came along in the 70s.
Wow.
As scientists developed ideas for the late stages of growing planets, where they realized that large objects could run into one another.
So the idea of the moon just sort of being caught in our orbit didn't really make sense. But this idea that something hit off the Earth and created the moon, that was something that really took hold in the 70s.
The idea was introduced. It was extremely controversial at the time. People had great debates about whether or not it would happen and what the outcome would be. But over time, as planet formation theory was developed, giant impacts have become completely entrenched as an accepted part of the end stage of planet formation.
And so what is the way we test a theory about moon formation as a scientist?
Ideally, the model would make predictions that could then be measured and then used to determine how good the model is. And one of the issues with studying the origin of the moon is we have a lot of data from the lunar rocks and from all the different chemical measurements we've made on these rocks. And the lunar data tell us that the moon is like a twin of the Earth, that it has a very similar chemical makeup, and most importantly, it has similar isotopes. That is, the different weights of the different elements are very similar between the Earth and the moon. So the way the giant impact theory has been tested is to build better and better computer models of the event. And that's where we ran into the problem. The computer models predicted that the moon would be made mostly out of the body that struck the Earth. And that was in direct conflict with the geochemical data that said that the moon was like Earth's twin.
Right. When you say the moon is like Earth's twin, what exactly do you mean?
So one way that we can tell where a meteorite comes from, just a rock that falls from space, is to measure the proportion of different isotopes of elements in that rock. And it's kind of like a fingerprint. Every planetary body has its own set of isotopic ratios because they're all made from slightly different material in the solar system.
So we now know that the Earth and Moon are similar. So that means they must have come from the same original formation, right?
So we would say that they're made from the same material, that they're built from the same building blocks, but basically the source of the Earth and the Moon have to be the same. And so if the model predicts that the Moon was made out of another planetary body, this body that struck the Earth, we would expect that its isotopes would be different.
Is it not possible for an impact to create the Moon and still have the same isotopes?
So where the theory was moving was to try and find a way to mix the two materials. But we'd have to mix them almost perfectly, because we can measure the isotopes of oxygen with extreme precision now. And those oxygen isotopes tell us that the two bodies have to be mixed completely.
Okay, so then we have a problem with this great impact theory, right?
Yes. And so several years ago, the scientific community was in a crisis, and some people were even arguing that we should throw out the whole theory and start all over with a new idea for the Moon.
So where did it come from then?
Where did the Moon come from? So what we've learned is that we didn't understand giant impacts. So the big new development was to improve the theory of what happened to a planet after a giant impact. And what my group learned is that we don't even have a planet anymore. We make an entirely new kind of astronomical object, and we gave it a special name. We called it a synestia. And it describes what happens to a planet when it gets too hot to be a planet anymore. So one of the criteria for being a planet is that it has a rounded shape. It's a spinning ball, and it has a spheroidal shape. But if you make the planet much hotter, it expands to the point where the equator is basically in orbit. And at that point, it doesn't satisfy the criteria of being a planet, and it's this new object called a synestia. And we propose that most giant impacts, based on our calculations, make synestias, and that the Moon grew inside the synestia, which is why the Moon looks like the Earth. And the synestia cools down over time by radiating to space and turns into the Earth, turns back into a planet.
Okay, so what you're having is essentially something crashing into a planet, the planet sort of heating up and almost shattering in a way, a Moon sort of forming out of this looser, sort of fatter Earth, and then cooling back down over time, creating two bodies and our unlikely Moon?
That's close to how I think about it. The giant impact doesn't shatter the Earth as much as it vaporizes the outer layers and makes the Earth into something more like Jupiter, something more like a gas giant planet where the outer layers are rock vapor and the inside is liquid, hot liquid rock down to the hot iron core. And so you think of transforming the Earth from a rocky planet with a small atmosphere to a huge vapor planet. And the Moon forms within that vaporous region.
Have we seen evidence of this new type of astronomical object in the universe around us?
We haven't yet, but astronomers are looking. Because we're watching so many stars for exoplanets, my student has developed a signature for synestias and what they would look like if they crossed in front of their star. And so there are astronomers looking because they would be bright enough to see.
So this idea, when you stick it into computer models, when you run your model of this sort of synesthetic impact, how does it work? I mean, do the numbers come out exactly the way you want them to?
So we can predict the formation of our large Moon with its bulk characteristics correctly. And the hardest part for us to predict in a computer model is how well mixed those isotopes are going to be. And so we can, based on what we've done so far, argue that many elements would be mixed, but it's hard for us today to say that oxygen would be perfectly mixed. And so that's an area that we're still working on.
Okay, so it looks good, but still more work to be done.
It's a brand new idea. The idea of this new astronomical object is new, and so we're still trying to understand what it's like. How, you know, what would the internal structure be like? How well can it mix within this structure?
How important was it to get samples from the moon for our understanding of where the moon came from?
It was the key piece of scientific evidence that we needed to overturn all of the previous ideas for the origin of the moon. And without those samples, we may still be teaching students, you know, the wrong thing in school.
When we think about the moon, it's this sort of constant in the sky, right? It seems like it's unchanging and constant and dependable, but it is a very unusual object, isn't it?
Our moon is strange. Compared to all the other moons in the solar system, our moon is large. It's much larger than the moons around Jupiter compared to Jupiter. And our moon has a tiny iron core, and so it's not made out of the same materials as the planets, even though it's a rocky body. And of course, it's dry and doesn't have an atmosphere or water on its surface. And so our moon is an odd duck, and that was one of the reasons why people were looking for sort of a special explanation for how to make it, because it is so different from other moons we see in the solar system.
And yet it gives us night and day, the tides and werewolves. And so what else could we want from the moon? Brilliant speaking with you, Sarah T. Stewart, planetary scientist and professor in the Department of Earth and Planetary Sciences at UC Davis. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
That is it for our moon special. Thanks to producer Aidan McKelvey, who put it together, Simon Keane on research, and Peter Molloy on sound. Thanks for listening.
Let it be you. 10, 9, ignition sequence start. 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. All engine running. Liftoff. We have a liftoff. 32 minutes past the hour. Liftoff on Apollo 11.
In just 50 minutes from now, well, within the hour, the moon is due to have visitors from another planet.
We got to get down, Eagle. Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed. Roger, Tranquility. We copy you on the ground. You got a bunch of guys about to turn blue. We're breathing again. Thanks a lot.
Oh, boy. What?
We're going to be busy for a minute.
While they say something, I'm speechless.
Surface is fine and powdery. I can pick it up loosely with my toe. It does adhere in fine layers, like powdered charcoal, to the sole and sides of my boots.
Man's dream, the nation's pledge, has now been fulfilled. The lunar age has begun.
Hello, Neil and Buzz. I'm talking to you by telephone from the Oval Room at the White House. And this certainly has to be the most historic telephone call ever made from the White House. Because of what you have done, the heavens have become a part of man's work.
How easy these words are rolling off our lips now. Man on the moon, a walk on the moon. And yet, to say the words and to stop just a moment to think about them still sends a shiver up and down the old spine.
It's one small step for man. One giant leap for mankind.